Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or a complete discussion of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. The show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. This week I'd like to go over some points from a Smart Money magazine article by Nancy Nahl Daringer. It's called 10 Things Credit Card Companies Won't Say. Number one, we're just waiting for you to screw up. Many things can bump your credit card interest rate into the red zone, but nothing faster than what's called universal default. You can make all your credit card payments religiously and for a long time, but fall behind on your electric bill and suddenly you're a deadbeat who will be charged accordingly. Rates can change on short notice from low and reasonable to up to 35%. Card companies claim that what they're doing is managing risk. Consumer groups disagree, since many people in universal default aren't deadbeats by any reasonable definition. Say, for example, you're disputing a charge on a medical bill or waiting for an insurance snafu to resolve itself. If a billing clerk kicks it to collections, you're in universal default. Or suppose your credit score drops, a common event that may be entirely unrelated to your bill-paying behavior. That's also likely to push your interest rate higher. The best way to avoid the problem is the most obvious. Pay your bills on time. Bankrate.com, a consumer lending education website, further advises that if you have a disputed bill, resolve it before it reaches the collection status. A second point that credit card companies won't tell you is, when it comes to identity theft, we're part of the problem. Identity theft victim Tom Skewley of Santa Barbara, California, says it started with a forged credit application. A $3,000 balance was mysteriously transferred to a new card in his name, followed by a ready-made check billed to one of his other cards. What can you do to avoid this sort of low-tech thievery? Buy a shredder and minimize the credit applications coming to your house by registering at optoutprescreen.com. Again, it's optoutprescreen.com. optoutprescreen.com. And continuing, but paper solicitations are only the tip of the iceberg. As internet security expert and author Bruce Schneier warns, data about you is not under your control. He points to examples such as the May 2005 case involving Bank of America in Wachovia, in which a man posing as a collection agent paid bank employees for customer data in New Jersey. The banks notified customers their data may have been compromised and offered to help watch their accounts for suspicious activity. In that case, the man, Orazio Lembo, pled guilty in March 2007, was sentenced to 5 years and a $20,000 fine. But John Hall, a spokesperson for the American Bankers Association, insists that banks have Pentagon-level security. His advice, monitor your accounts, protect your passwords, and your computer. As a personal aside, I noted that many banks in Iowa were recently hit. Their computer systems were hit, and their cards, their debit cards, and the numbers were taken and used, and they had to replace all those cards. So, Pentagon-level security is not really the truth. Continuing on, point number three of what credit card companies won't tell you is your children are our future. It wouldn't surprise most parents to know that their college-age kids can get a credit card. After all, university students, however financially dependent, are adults whose earning years are just beginning, making them good risks for creditors. What parents might not know is the fact that card issuers are now taking that reasoning a step further. According to Robert D. Manning, author of Credit Card Nation and a professor at Rochester Institute of Technology, the big trend is marketing to high school students. Manning says that most parents don't realize how early a child's name, address, and other information can turn up in the databases used by credit card companies to market their products, or that kids as young as 16 can get cards without parental permission. Card issuers know that if a kid gets in trouble, usually the parents will pay. So what can parents do? Protect your child's information and assume that all requests, however legitimate, will land it in a database somewhere. Gift cards, for instance, may offer protection if lost or destroyed, but they require personal data. Manning and other experts advise teaching teens about credit well before they get their first cards and monitoring their spending as they learn to use them. And a fourth point of what the car companies will not tell you is that our freebie rewards are anything but. In the hyper-competitive credit card marketplace, rewards are a way for banks to target big spending audiences, frequent flyers for instance. But programs often come with hidden catches, such as exorbitant interest rates, high annual fees. So it's important to do your homework. A reward card doesn't make financial sense for just anyone, says Manning of the Rochester Institute of Technology. Before signing on, figure out how much you'll have to spend to earn the incentives from a given card. If the math works out to anything less than one penny earned per dollar spent, or a mile per dollar in the case of mileage cards, then you could do better. Also, be sure to look for the rewards that best suit your needs. For example, if you want an abundance of options, from retail goods and services to charitable donations, American Express's membership rewards cards let you accumulate points at the rate of a penny per dollar spent, double that at gas stations and drugstores. Or, if it's air miles you're after, the United Mileage Plus Signature Visa is one card that stands out from the pack with this 1 mile per dollar ratio and a host of travel benefits, including upgrades. And a little advice from me in reviewing these points, I would suggest that it's almost always that you don't want to get these things, that they're not very useful. Credit cards right now are playing all kinds of games, and you will not really be getting any great benefit by getting these kinds of incentive cards, rewards cards at all. It's much better not to get cards in any event. The next point regards debit cards. Debit cards should come with a warning: use at your risk. A few summers ago, Vicky Jacobson's college student's son, Craig, was coming home from a European vacation. Arriving at the airport, unable to speak Italian, and his available cash growing short, he attempted to pay for his taxi ride with a debit card. The driver ran the card 3 times and a credit card once, but it was unclear after each pass whether the transaction had gone through. Finally, anxious about catching his flight, Craig paid with his dwindling euros and left Italy behind. You can probably guess what happened. He was charged for that taxi ride 3 times on the debit card and once on the credit card. And that's when the fun really started. Months after the incident, the credit card charge was nearly resolved, but they were still unable to make any headway on the 3 erroneous debit charges. It can be very difficult to penetrate the system, Vicky Jacobson says. Why so much trouble with the debit card transactions? Well, debit cards resemble credit cards in all visible ways, but have fewer protections for the consumer. Some debit cards offer purchase protection, meaning you can replace a damaged item within 90 days, but many do not. So be careful. You have to find a bank that gives that kind of card that gives protection. And although unauthorized transactions, like the 3 charged to Jacobson's son, are supposed to be refunded by the issuer, banks are less motivated to speedily resolve cases involving debit cards than credit cards. Why? debit cards draw on a checking account, meaning they're essentially checks in plastic form. Credit cards, by contrast, constitute a loan, meaning it's the bank's money, giving it more reason to protect it. So the bottom line here is find a good, reputable bank that will stand behind your debit card transactions. And I will continue on some more of these points next week. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. In the second segment of the show, I'm going to go back into our concept of love and money, relationships and money, and go over the 8 golden rules about that relationship. Before I get started, I want to give an important credit. The thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, two of America's leading champions for debtors, and I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. Also, we've been talking about many, many wonderful issues for months and months now. This is an educational program. You can visit all of the former programs in the archives at www.kruufm.com, archives for life and debt, and you can learn tremendous amounts of important information on how to deal with your debt and how to create a program for future economic stability and success in your life. But I'll start out with this, some points I've gone over last week. I've been reviewing the 8 golden rules in relationships. And once again, talking about relationships, I'm talking about stable, long-term commitments on all levels, not just financial level, a marriage, a partnership that really has a lifetime future commitment associated with it. So rule number 1, which we've discussed, is regarding money. What's mine is ours. One of the traditional concepts is one bank account or two. And what we have said is it really doesn't matter. But what is important is that you are organized. Some people like many checking accounts. Some people like many folders in the way they organize their life. But what is important, it's all ours. And it isn't mine and the others. My account and your account, my money and your money are not proper concepts in a relationship that is a long-term relationship. And of course, that means that if you're not committed, not legally married or spiritually married, one or the other, then you can say it's yours because your lives are somewhat separate and you haven't promised to stay together forever. So your money stays separate too, and those bank accounts, bills, big decisions are largely separate also. Any financial sharing you agree on is just that, an agreement to be negotiated and renegotiated according to the situation. However, if you are married, then things really are different. When you get married, the money becomes ours. By and large, that's really even the law, and it's actually much more practical. Like most couples, the assets belong to both of you, the debts belong to both of you, and the money and the decisions about money belong to both of you. So what's mine is ours. It isn't possible for one of you to be poor while the other is rich. If this marriage is to last for a lifetime, you're going to retire together and be in comfort together, not one in comfort and the other living out in the street, one living in a mansion, etc. In short, you are married and so is your money. And an important principle here is that this may have to be initiated by one of you because the other person isn't really completely on board yet with these ideas we've been teaching. And you don't want to think, well, why should he be obligated to you while you aren't obligated to him and vice versa? Keeping score like this guarantees that you both become losers. So you got to do it from your side and hold on to the reality that what is mine is ours. Sometimes we get in some justice concept about fairness, etc., but fairness really means sharing, and you share everything for better or for worse. It's a lot better when you pool the money and don't worry too much about yours and mine. And of course, this usually translates into joint checking accounts. The account is under both names, you both have access, you both know where you stand financially. And the joint account is for those bare necessities, the mortgage payment, rental payment, car payments, food, all those basic things. It's really important that things get budgeted properly for those basic bills. And the real efficiency and luxury of this is that you have your wants and savings components, which we've discussed at length here, and you've agreed to this ahead of time, and the percentages are all worked out. You don't have to squabble over little purchases. You have that $1,000 cushion in your joint checking account just in case there is something that happens that was not planned. And so every month, essentially, your checking account statement should look roughly the same. The paychecks are going in, and the amounts are being paid for the bare necessities. And then there's a check for wants, which gives you some money to play with, and then a fixed amount going into savings. So that's all done in a very clear way. On the other hand, if you want to keep separate checking accounts, they're not necessarily bad, but there should be some conditions. You need to know where you stand financially with each other. It's not okay to use separate accounts to keep secrets. You must both accept 100% responsibility. That means it is not okay to use separate accounts as an excuse for saying that her credit card balance is her problem and I covered my bills, so why should I worry? The money and the bills still belong to both of you, even if you find it more convenient to manage from your separate accounts. And then lastly, you make the big decisions together. It's perfectly fine to splurge on the wants category, that new pair of shoes, going out to the movies, going out bowling with your friends. It's not okay to buy a new car or to empty your retirement account without complete agreement. If you can't agree on big decisions, that is no excuse. Keep on talking until you find a reasonable compromise. And even if your accounts are separate, you have a joint financial future, which means you need to work together on the plans that will have a major impact on your lives. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Continuing our overall review of the golden rules about love and money, we're on rule number 2, be truthful and make it easy for your partner to be truthful too. And as we've said in the past, good relationship is based on trust. It's very easy to hide things in relationships when it comes to money, credit card bills, checks that have been written, a few secrets here and there, a white lie there. Life seems to kind of go on smoother at that moment, and you feel you don't have to defend anything. You are perhaps working on a cash basis, and like that, there are no records there. Remember that a few little lies eventually do hurt. After a while, a little thread here, a little thread there, a lot of things your partner doesn't know about, you may find yourself telling bigger lies just to keep up. You are not bad. In fact, you may have the best intentions in the world, but it's more and more in your relationship situation that gets damaged. There's evasion, cover-up, and denial, and this starts to permeate out everywhere in the relationship. So mistrust and evasions over money can be one of the most difficult cycles to break. If your partner isn't honest about money, then you may say, well, why should I be? Well, there's just really one reason. It's because the only way to save your relationship is to be honest, really and truly. Mistrusting your partner about money is no different from mistrusting your partner about anything else. Suspicion will eat away at your relationship day after day. So the solution is you can decide that from now on you will be totally honest with him or her about money no matter what. No more lying, no more covering up, no more hiding receipts or holding back on how much overtime pay you got. just the plain and simple truth. And on the other side of that, the other half of your commitment is that one that makes all the difference between good intentions and real success is make it easy on your partner to be truthful too. You may not be able to force him or her to tell the truth, but you can promise that you will never belittle that person, never make him or her feel bad, never criticize that person when he or she tells the truth. That is what a marriage, a long-term partnership, is all about. Sticking it out for better or for worse, and to be sympathetic towards the other person. Get honest. Ultimately, you can't hide decisions from your most intimate partner. You have the things you bought. You owe the money you borrowed. If you keep adding the lies together, someday it will all crash down around you. So don't do it. The decision right here, right now, to tell the truth. Make it easy for your partner to tell the truth too. If you do, you'll do better with money and you'll be better with each other, which is what it's all about. The third golden rule is stop playing the blame game. You can say to yourself, which one of you is responsible for your money, you or your mate? That sounds like a reasonable question, but the answer is both of you. It can be easy and satisfying, however, to blame your partner for all your money troubles. Each of you have probably made some bad decisions when it comes to money, or gone off in directions, and you can create lists of sins on and on for each of you. So what should you do about it? Well, from our perspective, you just let it go. Let the past be past. It's hard to be that magnanimous, and it's not that forgiveness is divine, although that is true, forgiveness is divine, but we may not be on that level, but we can really look at it in terms of ourself. In a sense, be selfish, get over it, because really this is best for you in the long run. As Professor Warren often says, you're forgiving your mate because you can't afford not to. The blame game is the fastest road to the poorhouse. An eye for an eye spending will leave you both blind and broke. So you need to get over it so you have a chance to get ahead financially. When you forgive, you take 100% responsibility for your actions. You decide what you know is right, and that's the right thing to do with money, no matter what your partner does. There's no more giving yourself permission to do things you know aren't smart just because your mate has blown a bunch of money. So you just have to do the right thing. You get straight what you can get straight, regardless of what your partner is doing. And of course, your partner, when you've made a mistake, may shake that long finger of blame in your direction to send the best of intentions flying out the window. But instead of battling it out, our principle is try this. The next time your partner brings up a mistake you made, try saying, "You are right. I did make a mistake." And mean it. An honest confession can suck the wind right out of the sails of self-righteousness. So this is what you're going to do. The blame game is about mistakes from the past, but if blame causes you to compound past mistakes by making more stupid mistakes, then you are letting yesterday's mistakes ruin your future. You cannot change yesterday, but you can decide what to do today, which will have an effect on today and tomorrow. You can decide to let yesterday's mistakes be something of the past, and you can learn whatever lesson you needed to learn and just move on. When a person decides to let the blame eat away at their happiness, then that is a very, very enervating, life-sucking decision. You, however, can decide to care more about living a good life today and about making a better tomorrow, and that's much more intelligent. No matter what the situation is, who earns the money, no matter who spends the money, you are both 100% responsible, because the issue is the relationship, not just the money. It is time to let go of the blame game and to let go of the past, and it will give you a better future. Not just financially, but in your relationship. And the fourth golden rule we will review is give each other some free money. If you've been following the course of this show, the wants portion of your disposable monthly income has been thought about, been apportioned, and has been allotted to each of you. And that's a very important concept. This is money that you can have a personal spice space in your life where nothing gets reviewed by your partner. And of course, the money has to be there, and there may not be much considering past debt and issues, but it allows you to have some free money, and it's premised on honesty. Agreeing on what you really can afford, that's great, and how much needs to be given here and how much needs to be given there. If this was done in the past, then it really banishes the worry that overspending may drive you into bankruptcy. The amount has been fixed, you've decided together what is reasonable, and you need to trust each other to live within the bounds you have agreed upon, and that is really an act of trust. Whatever you have figured out you can afford, that's the bottom line. And it is also important to recognize that no matter how tight your budget, even if you are down to shaking nickels out of your kid's piggy bank, every person in every relationship needs to make a little room for individual fun money, because you need to have that quality in your life to make life feel fulfilling. Once you've agreed on free money, you make it really and truly free. And there are no right purchases, no wrong purchases. No one should be pointing out how much money could have been better spent. You give each other the space, and that's a wonderful thing. Golden rule number 4. And then last for this week, we'll talk about golden rule number 5, which means to keep money issues separate from the real stuff. Because sometimes we are having problems with money. That is what this show and course mostly is about. However, sometimes money is just a weapon that people use to fight over something completely different in their relationship. There are honest emotions, and they can figure in to every relationship's battles and issues. And yet, when the battle comes up, it gets switched to money. And it could also be that it's not between the two of you, it's between something entirely else. Stress at work, a dispute with family members or neighbors. There's really no magic formula to make those feelings go away. But substituting money for the real issues will not resolve any of the deeper problems. Worse yet, it can create a large number of new ones that just compound whatever else is wrong. And just reflect on it. If every conflict that you have in your relationship turns into a battle over your finances, try keeping the word money out of the quarrels. You've made decisions to keep your money in balance. You're getting on the road, which is brighter, to a better financial future. You've forgiven the past mistakes. You've decided to put an end to the blame game. You've agreed to give each other some free money, want money, so there's no need to quarrel over little purchases. There just shouldn't be very many money issues left to fight about. You want to live. You want to laugh. You want to be simple, natural, spontaneous, and that may mean a little bickering here and there, but keep money out of it. If money is no longer the first weapon in your arsenal, you'll get a better understanding about what is really wrong, which means you can deal with those things personally through therapy, but it's not a money issue. You get a better chance to make it right. You can find techniques to help you get rid of your stress, but that is not the same thing as using money as a weapon. So I will continue next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.